Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and welcome to Dwell, a Circe Institute podcast by homeschool moms for homeschool moms. I am your host, Karen Kern, and I'm here today again with my friend and co-host, Renee Mathis. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Karen. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Day here. I hope it's sunny where you are.
Yeah, well, it is sunny now. It was rainy this morning. I really should say that we are grandmothers, right? Like, we're not homeschooling moms anymore or homeschooling grandmas.
But do we ever stop being homeschooling moms?
No, I guess we don't. No.
Get to claim that title forever.
Yeah. Today I got to go with my daughter, who was 38 weeks pregnant, to her OB appointment with her daughters, and we got to see the ultrasound. And then we went to the Mint Museum downtown Charlotte. We looked at art and, you know, china and pottery and teapots from many years past. And we went to Chick-fil-A. And then they were going to come in and have tea. But Andrew, their papa, was recording Ask Andrews in the kitchen with Graham. So they couldn't come in for tea. They were very sad.
But it sounds like a lovely day, though.
It was a lovely day. And now here I am talking to you.
Yeah, this is good. And now we get to talk about one of our favorite books.
We do.
It's the latest installment in our Renee and Karen Go Through Norms and Nobility by Hicks. And we're on chapter 2, The Word is Truth. Karen, why do classical educators love words so much?
Because as this says, the word is truth. You know, like, we choose when we're writing or when we're speaking, we want just the right word. And when we have that right word, it just brings so much, a moment of joy, right? And it's words that we communicate with, that God communicates with us through. And, you know, all the way back to God spoke creation into being, and Jesus is the Word. In the beginning was the Word, the Logos. And so it's so much more than just letters, sound symbols on a page. It gives truth to us, right, to our souls.
It does. And I know we just, in my apprenticeship, we just got through talking a couple of days ago through one of Wendell Berry's chapters in his essay called Standing by Words. Mm-hmm. And I love the way he puts it in the same similar fashion, that when you stand by your words, that is a commitment to not only believe something is true, but to follow it up with action and to do that thing, right? It's almost like taking a marriage vow, right? Not only am I pledging my love and commitment to this person, but I'm going to do what it takes to put that in action. And that's what Hicks talks about so beautifully in this book, that education is not just knowing, but it's knowing what to do. What is the appropriate, wise, kind, loving, insert your adjective, thing to do in this particular moment.
Right. And so, like, that harkens back to last time in chapter 1, we were talking about wisdom and virtue. wisdom, right. You know, knowing what to do and virtue, having the courage to do it, put into action. It's like love. Love doesn't really mean anything if it's just a feeling in your heart, if it's not shown, if it's not acted on. The other person doesn't experience your love unless it's spoken with a word or acted on with an action.
So as homeschool moms, we're wanting, of course, our children to be educated. And one of the seven liberal arts, or I, you should say that the trivium of the seven liberal arts, the first three, are all wrapped up in language.
Right.
The grammar and rhetoric are learning to use language well. So when we're teaching these little ones how to read and spell and handwriting and sounding out phonics and all of that, we're teaching them the riches that come with knowing language.
Yeah, I was reminded of that in the car today because at Chick-fil-A, Serafina got this little book. You know what? The little toy at Chick-fil-A is a book now. And she wanted to open up and read it, and she's just learning to read. And so she was sounding out the words, and I said, just spell it to me. And she was, no, I want to sound it out to you. And she was trying to figure out this word, and it turned out to be beneath. And she was so excited. She was so excited when she was able to unravel that word and get the word, you know. And then one of the words were fronds. It was a little story about what, about undersea, underwater sea life. And there was a frond. And she said, what's a frond? So it was just like, just a little picture of uncovering the wonders and the glory of learning language.
Mm-hmm.
The joy of being able to sound out a word for the very first time.
And that is so much fun about, that's one of the best things about homeschooling is you get to be there when that happens.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Watch those light bulbs come on.
It was going off the back seat behind me, you know?
So in this chapter, Hicks is talking about two big terms, and we're going to kind of take that apart for a little bit. One is logos, obviously, you know, from the Greek word, but the other is mythos, M-Y-T-H-O-S, mythos and logos. And of course, myth, that's where we get our word myth.
Right.
And Hicks is going to tell us why especially mythos is important. But as we were talking a little bit before we started recording, there are some things we need to clarify when it comes to the word myth.
It reminded me of how growing up I was in a wonderful Protestant denomination, non-denominational, that was pietistic, and I say that in a positive way. It was wonderful. But the word myth would have only had a negative connotation. A myth would have been something that we don't believe. So of course we didn't believe the Greek myths, because obviously, you know, they're not real. We don't worship Zeus. But it didn't really allow for the idea of a positive understanding of the word mythos and its place in talking about tradition, plot structure and stories, the importance of stories, what it lends to our imagination. And it definitely, I would never have heard the words, the phrase, the true myth, meaning referring to God or the Bible, or that Jesus was an ideal type coming from the idea of mythos. You know, none of that was part of my background. So I had to learn all that. But I don't think that that's just an explanation that we don't have to be afraid of the word myth. It doesn't necessarily mean untrue story.
Right. There are truths contained.
Right. Truths hidden in the myths that we
can absorb those. We can recognize them and talk about them. You know, we're not saying that we as homeschoolers, we worship pagan gods. Hicks is not telling us to go and worship pagan gods. In no way are we saying that the Greek myths are on the same level as scripture, by no means. But they are an important part of what has formed our Western civilization. And they were part of the world that Jesus was born into. And so we need to know what they are and what they say and what they teach. They're also just really, in a lot of ways, lot of them, not all of them, but there's some good stories in there.
And yeah, good character stories and warnings, you know, don't be jumping off of tall buildings with fake wings.
Don't open things that you should not open. So, you know, we don't want to discount the importance of a good story in passing along our cultural heritage. And so, and I think that's what Hicks is getting at in this chapter. Not just when he says mythos, he's not talking about jumping off the tall building with fake wings. He's talking about the stories that shape us. And so we were going to kind of, Karen and I have highlighted much of the same things in our book.
Yeah.
So we wanted to kind of go through the chapter and highlight a few of these sentences that tell us why myth is important and what it does for us. So I'll let you get started with
Well, let's see. So in the middle of page 29, you know, there it talks about that mythos, I'll just read this. The mythos represents man's imaginative and ultimately spiritual effort to make this world intelligible. The logos sets forth his rational attempt to do the same. So we can say that mythos is like the heart and logos is like the head. So we learn from stories and we learn from poetry. And we learn also by more analytical means with the heart, the head, I mean. So that's kind of comparing the two there. Mythos is the spiritual effort to make the world intelligible, and the logos is the rational attempt to do the same. So there's a place for both of these things. I think that's it. That's a good thing to remember, that we don't just think about classical education as mythos, but
right, and
logos as well, the ideas.
He's not trying to put them in competition with one another, but rather each needs its proper place. If you were trying to survive on logos alone, on rationality alone, I think you'd quickly go insane.
Right.
Well, that's not my idea. I got that from G.K. Chesterton's book, Orthodoxy, when he talks about insanity. But they don't fight one another. You need the mythos for those abstract, transcendent ideals that you can't always put your finger on.
Yeah, and it makes me think of what C.S. Lewis says, that we read to know we're not alone. And so when we read of others' journeys or struggles or battles, or we read about, you know, we read Homer about getting home, that those kinds of stories, they tell us that we are all on a journey. When we read Dante, it starts with the recognition that we're all in some way in a dark forest or in the wilderness. You know,
speaking of the wilderness, a good myth is like a good map,
right,
and it enables the wanderer to survive in the wilderness.
Right. Yeah, and then he compares it to John Bunyan sending his pilgrim walking through the wilderness, or Moses descending from Mount Sinai into the wilderness of a spiritual odyssey. So we're all on a spiritual odyssey of some form. So in some ways, we're all on an identical spiritual odyssey, but mm-hmm. that each of our lives takes slightly different details.
Right. But so we have our good myth. We have our map.
Yeah.
But we also know through myths that our chances of survival are going to be better if we're not by ourselves.
Right.
And there is the importance of community and being members of one another, with one another, in something bigger than ourselves, that is so valuable. I mean, our society that shares these common myths then gives us something to hold on to.
Right. I think that's why a book like Jane Eyre is so beloved, because it puts so many of those archetypes out there, the orphan,
mm-hmm.
you know, of lost love, of doing the right thing, of courage,
mm-hmm.
you know, of being out in the wilderness and not really surviving and almost dying and coming back home. Like it's just a microcosm of so many of those mythological ideas.
And she is, I love her as a character. She's such a strong character.
Yeah.
That one scene where she was like, I could choose the wrong thing. Right. I could go down the wrong path. But everything in my life up till now has trained me to make the right choice. And that is what I'm going to hold on to, even though it's hard.
Yeah.
Like, okay, people who say that, you know, Victorians or whatever did not know how to write women well have never been there because it's incredible.
Yeah. So that's just an example of that line that you read at the bottom of page 29, one's chances of survival in the wilderness are greater when one is not alone. So it's an example of that.
Yeah. Hicks goes on to say, though, that myths assure us of more than just a healthy psyche. Mm-hmm. They give us a basis for our civilized acts.
That's a really strong comment, right? Yeah.
We don't have to invent civilization all on our own. It is already there. We just need to act on what we know. And how do we know? Because of the story.
Yeah. And because they embody good and evil.
Right.
Yeah. And then he talks about a passage here from the Song of Psalms. Song of Songs, how beautiful you are, my love, how beautiful. And then it goes on to describe her body in terms of, you know, fruit and animals and everything in nature and how lovely that is and the power of that rather than just, you know, it offers you images mm-hmm. For describing things in poetry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in poetry, to appreciate love through poetry. It's a very civilized thing when you think about it.
Yeah. And then previous to that, I talked about archetypes. I touched on a little bit on that, but that's what myths do is they offer us those archetypes, which children's literature is full of. Mm-hmm. You know, I think and we've talked about this before, but every five-year-old understands that a wolf is a bad character. And right. Dark forest is a scary place to be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, princesses are needing to be rescued or are struggling to do the right thing, you know, and
it was mentioned in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe at one point when the kids are kind of lost and there's the line that, well, they had been raised on the right stories. So right. they knew where they were. They knew what to
expect. Yeah. I think that's in Voyage of the Dawn Treader. I think so. Yeah. Eustace Clarence Scrub, maybe he's describing. Didn't get the right stories.
He did not get the right story.
No. yeah.
Another strong comment, the mythos is the very skeleton of civilization.
Yeah. Yeah, it says, remove it and watch all the flesh of political stability, scientific invention, and social sophistication collapse. Myths remind men to think and to act out of a sense of responsibility toward the past. We were talking earlier, you reminded me that that's one of the things about classical education. That's one of our goals, right, is to act responsibly toward the past.
Right, which means to take the good and right. preserve that and hold on to it and conserve that good, at the same time recognizing that it's not perfect. And, you know, people who are acting out of a sense of ideals may not have always lived those ideals out perfectly, but it's not the ideals' fault, right? We don't fault the ideals. So therefore we ask ourselves, how can we do it better?
Yeah.
Or how can we take this forward in such a way that it helps and benefits even more people than it did in the past?
Yeah, it was right after that. He said, myths inspire man to perform great and selfless deeds by assuring and warning them that their actions are not individual, but symbolic. And goes on, their actions and ideas have never-ending consequences. That reminds me of the book. You know, of course, ideas have consequences.
Right, they do.
Yeah.
And the more stories we read, the more we need to learn to ask those questions. What will the consequences of this action be? What will my choice, how will that ripple out and affect other people or affect my neighborhood or my family or my home or my school?
Right. And then further down, Myth grounds the student in time while animating his eternal soul. So again, that might be the first time, maybe not the first time that he's mentioned the word soul in this chapter. I don't know, but all of this presupposes that we believe in the soul, right? And so to compare it to modern education, you can't start with that assumption. I remember my daughter when she was in college, I don't remember what class it was, but her professor said, raise your hand if you believe that we have a soul. And she was the only student, maybe there was one other, who raised her hand.
Wow.
And so if college students aren't, if you get all the way to college and you're not sure if you have a soul, then of course, obviously, that's a sign that you weren't reading the right stories. You weren't fully educated.
Right.
You know, I don't know what education you got, but it was so deficient.
Caught up in the myth, the student measures his deeds against his dreams, his ambitions against his altruisms, his despair against his faith, and thereby receives a complete vision of himself as he lives in all his domains, individual, social, and religious.
Yeah.
Again, Hicks is making some very big claims here, but I think he's right to do so because we need to be shaken up a little bit and be reminded of how important these stories are.
Yeah. And then he goes on in this next part. I think he talks there about Plato and the Logos. He's starting to introduce the idea of the Logos. And then the idea of the permanent things.
Mm-hmm.
And he explains he uses the word valor as an example of a permanent thing on page 33. A student cannot experience valor through analysis any more than he can a distributor cap through imagination. Hence, the analytical method itself calls into question the utility and reality of such concepts of valor, while affirming that of the distributor cap. So the idea that we have to, we're not teaching things like valor anymore. We're teaching only analytical things.
Right. And when we do that, we've taken the heart out of education. I mean, we take away the stories, we take away these abstract ideas and concepts, which, you remember, abstract just means you can't touch it. It doesn't mean it's not real. So he says words like valor and courage and courtesy, gentleness, honesty, and love. Those words contain a moral imperative within those words. And how do we communicate not only what love is, but what you're supposed to do with it? And what is the right thing to do with love? What is the right thing to do with courage? So, because we are not, brains walking around on sticks or just a collection of cells, those words have meaning.
So that kind of fits in with, page 34, part 3. The first sentence there is, at the heart of classical education is the word, the complete mastery of its shades of meaning, of its action implicit imperatives. And so there we get into the idea of logos, but it's not that it's in contrast or conflict with mythos.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more that they have different jobs to do,
mm-hmm,
to get to the same goal. And
right.
We think about Christ, we call Christ the Logos, capital L. And we also, call him the true myth. So Christ the Logos is myth, capital M.
But also the word.
He brings it together.
Yeah, he's the unifying principle. The one unifying thing that the Greeks were looking for all along is what God sent in Christ.
And that's why Christians can read the pagans, because Christ fulfills those all of those qualities that the pagans were looking for, all of those heroes that the pagans were looking for, everything that they were trying to express were fully expressed in Christ.
Mm-hmm. And it's, I think, a good reminder that that's why the first three liberal arts, the trivium, are language-centered, because in order to understand complete thoughts and words and their meanings and their definitions, and then to use those to create rational, logical arguments within rhetoric, for example, now you're ready to go forth and do science. Now you're ready to go forth and maybe understand the sciences as the arts of how the world works, right? But in that sense, you know, again, logos and mythos aren't in conflict with one another, but you need the mythos to provide that overarching coherence of this is the world and how it works. Now we can think about it. So I wonder if we could talk, for as we kind of finish up, okay, homeschool moms, you know, you're sitting there thinking this is great. What stories do we read? How do we know what a good story is? How do I introduce my five-year-old to this idea of myths and stories? So Karen, where would you advise that people start?
Well, fairy tales, Bible stories. And one really great thing to do is compare stories. Mm-hmm. So you might have a character in a King Arthur story or a fairy tale that is like David, the boy, King David, when he was a boy, fighting Goliath, you know. Or you might hear a story where somebody is saved from something, or there is somebody who is sick and is healed, or, you know, and to compare the stories between Bible stories and fairy tales, or fairy tale to fairy tale, or fable, you know, talk about the lion, you know, the fable with the lion and the mouse, and sure, compare that to another story. So that then children start to understand and see patterns of stories and mm-hmm. themes that are in more than, you know, many stories,
right?
Or archetypes or character qualities. You know, who else had courage, or what other story can you think of where somebody was kind to somebody who was weak? I don't know. Like, there's so many, and right. Kids pick them up so easily. Sometimes
you'll know you're successful with introducing all these stories when you know turn around and find that they're playing make believe.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'll be the king and you be the princess, or I'll be this and you be that, and they've absorbed that into their souls already, and it just comes out.
Yeah, or sometimes if you don't know what question to ask, you can say, "How is this like something else?" Mm-hmm. These two things are always alike in some way.
Right. What would you have done if you were in their situation, or do you think you should have done that?
Right.
Off and running. So yeah, fairy tales, fables, the tried and true, the classics. And then of course the good stories, C.S. Lewis, Tolkien, MacDonald.
Yeah. The children's Homer.
Yes.
Black Ships Before Troy.
Right. The children's Homer doesn't have pictures. So what we're talking about here, it's just it's a paperback. Or mine was a paperback.
Hey,
the illustrated Rosemary Sutcliffe.
Yeah.
Black Ships Before Troy, which is the Iliad, and In Search of a Homeland. No, In Search of a Homeland is Aeneid, and that's by Penelope Lively. And then, what's the Rosemary Sutcliffe's Odyssey? What's it called? The Wanderings of Odysseus.
Mm, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So not only do you get the great pictures,
they're all beautifully illustrated.
You get a kid-friendly story. And then there's the Dolaire's Greek myths.
Oh, yeah.
Beautiful pictures in there.
And there's King Arthur stories.
Yes. Yeah. King, for sure. And then Bible. You know, the Bible is full of wonderful stories. And we just scratched the surface. When we only stick with Daniel in the lion's den and David and Goliath, we're missing it. Because there's a lot of good stuff.
The Book of Numbers is full of them, obscure stories. So today at the Mint Museum, there was a big painting on the wall of Well, you just saw a man by a well and a woman at the well. And when you see the colors that the man is wearing, you realize pretty quickly Serafina picked out that that was Jesus. And then it was the story of the woman at the well. And we were able to remember that story together by looking at this huge painting. But, you know, that was just an example of how the six-year-old has enough biblical literacy that she was able to pick out that this big painting was that story. And those are gifts that we give our kids to be able to remember stories when they see art. You know, just a small example of the what we offer them.
And then, you know, of course, don't forget the importance of your own family stories. Well, you know, maybe not classic myths that are thousands of years old, just the idea of a story being important to your family and your family's culture. So tell the stories of those great-grandparents or the great-great-grandparents and what they did and where they lived and where they traveled and where they moved to and settled. And all of that gives us that map, right? That reminds us we're not wandering and we're not alone.
Yeah. And then there are good cultural stories, you know, like all the American heroes, George Washington, you know, and, oh, I don't know. I have in my composition class, we're working on research stories now. So somebody is doing Wild Bill Hickok and somebody is doing Annie Oakley. You know, I'm actually writing one too on Sojourner Truth. So here's a funny story. Well, it's not funny. I found interesting. I told them I would write essay too. So I'm reading all about Sojourner Truth. Mm-hmm. And then I was reading in the Psalms the day that I was researching her. And I saw a verse that said the sojourners, it preceded that by the statement of those who were enslaved. And then it said sojourners looking for truth or something like that. I can't remember the exact wording. And I thought that's where she got her name.
Yeah.
And so when I was reading the Psalms, I got to make that connection. And so I thought that was awesome. So of course a child's going to enjoy that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah.
The connections are everywhere. You just have to start looking for them and then they just pop up.
Yeah.
Well, Karen, thanks. This has been fun. It's been a good reminder and a good review of what Hicks says about myths and the importance of stories for us, for our kids, for our families. And so those of y'all who are listening, if you have questions, feel free to drop us a line and ask or find us on our Facebook page, in our Facebook group. Share some of your favorite stories and your sources. And until next time, here's to home.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.